Well, ladies and gentlemen, it's a great pleasure to be here in Southampton in this great city and university and to talk about this theme. And as many of you will know, actually, C.S. Lewis died on this very day back in 1963. So it's good to kind of just reflect on some of the ideas that he developed. And what I want to do is explore with you some of these themes of faith. For some of you, you know, faith raises deep questions. How can we hold on to something when we cannot actually absolutely prove it's true? And these are very good questions. And in this talk tonight, what I want to try and do is open up some of these questions. And if I don't deal with things properly in the talk, then we have plenty of time afterwards for Q&A. And I'd be very glad indeed just to see where you want to lead the conversation afterwards. If I'd known that I was going to be giving this talk when I was in high school back in the 1960s, I'd have been very surprised. Because back in those days, I was an atheist myself. And I think there were several reasons for being an atheist. One of them was that I was studying sciences at high school. As Keith said, I went on to study chemistry and then do a doctorate in molecular biophysics at Oxford. And at that stage, it just seemed obvious to me. You know, you cannot be a scientist and a religious believer, because science is about proving what you think is right, whereas religious belief is kind of up in the air stuff. You know, you make the stuff up as you go along. And for me, that was just a no-no. There was something else, of course. I grew up in Northern Ireland. I've lost my accent, but in the 1960s, Northern Ireland was noted for its religious tensions. Of course, it still is. And you may know the very famous story about the Englishman who arrived in Belfast one evening. He stayed out far too late. He came back. On his way back to his hotel, he was confronted by a group of Belfast youths with baseball bats. And they forced him against the wall, and they looked at him and said, "Are you a Protestant or are you a Catholic?" And the Englishman thought long and hard. Then he had a stroke of genius. He said, "I'm an atheist." There was a slight pause. And then, "Are you a Protestant atheist or are you a Catholic atheist?" So you see, these sort of things made me feel that atheism was the right thing for any thinking person. And I think I want to begin by saying that, atheism comes in all kinds of sorts. I mean, in my case, I was a rather aggressive atheist. In fact, when I read Richard Dawkins these days, I get all nostalgic because that's the way I used to be myself. But there'll be many here tonight who actually would say, well, I'm an atheist. And what you may well mean by that is just, look, I don't believe in God, but I'm open-minded about these things. I want to keep on thinking. And certainly, I hope I'll be able to say something tonight which you may find helpful. Although I'm no longer an atheist, I'm still very respectful towards it, because I think atheism does ask some very good questions. One of them would be exactly the question I began with. Why believe something when the evidence doesn't force you to? So perhaps we should start immediately just by facing that question straight on. It seems to me to be absolutely right to say, look, we've got to be able to give reasons for what we believe. There has to be evidence, there has to be rational thought behind what we believe. And that's absolutely right. The issue really is, how far can we take this? Are there limits to what reason and evidence can actually show us? Some of you may have read a very famous essay by the Oxford historian of ideas, Sir Isaiah Berlin. It's a very interesting paper. And in this, Isaiah Berlin says, look, when we look at all the great thoughts that people have had down the ages, basically, they fall into three categories. Those that can be proved by science, those that can be proved by logic, and those you can't prove either of those ways. And interestingly, Berlin made this point, that the beliefs that really matter are all actually in the third class. In other words, things you can't prove. And Berlin was making the point that if you have political beliefs, well, you can't prove those. If you have moral beliefs, you can't prove those. If you have religious beliefs, you can't prove those. If you have anti-religious beliefs, you can't prove those. But nevertheless, these really matter to us. Very often, these are what give us our lives direction and animation. They're really important to us. And although it's true you can't prove them, you can nevertheless say there are good reasons for thinking that they are right. In other words, we do have to face up to this fact that only shallow truths can be proved. You know, I can prove that 2 and 2 make 4. I don't think that's going to excite you very much. It won't give you a reason for getting up in the morning, but at least you're pretty sure about that. When we start looking at big questions like human rights, ethics, God, we have to realize that there are limits to what human reason is actually able to demonstrate. And that is just the way we are as human beings. Terry Eagleton, who's a very able cultural commentator, used to be an art Marxist, simply made the point that we have to get used to the fact that there are many beliefs that we find it absolutely reasonable to hold, but we know we can't prove them. And that, I think, is a very important point to make. If you read Richard Dawkins, you sometimes get the impression that kind of way science gives you 100% proof, religion gives you 0% proof. Actually, it's much more complicated than that. It's a spectrum of possibilities. And very often those beliefs that really matter, what you might call existential beliefs, things that really impact on life, sure, they're on that spectrum, but they're not at the zero end and they're not at the 100 end. So we've got to face up to this fact that there are things that really matter to us that can't be proved, but nevertheless we can give good reasons for them. And that lets me bring in C.S. Lewis, who was not simply intensely aware of this fact, but also, in effect, began to open up the question of the limits of reason in a really helpful way. As a young man, Lewis was an atheist. He grew up in Belfast, like I did. He was an atheist. He went up to Oxford to begin to study classics and then ended up fighting in the First World War, where he got very badly wounded. And Lewis just thought it was obvious for any thinking person, you have to be an atheist. And interestingly, he saw his experience in the First World War as reinforcing this. Look, he'd say, look, if there was a God, why is all this trauma happening? Why is this war happening? Why is there so much suffering? It's all God's fault. Then he began to realize, actually, he was an atheist who didn't believe there was a God. You couldn't blame God for this. And actually, that brought home to him as a rather more uncomfortable explanation that since you had to rule out God as there was no God, then in effect, human beings were responsible for this mess. He found that a very uncomfortable thought, but one that kind of lingered in his thinking as he began to wonder where he went from there. In his autobiography, Surprised by Joy, which I'm sure many of you have dipped into, Lewis tries to describe the position he found himself in as a rationalist atheist. And he said, you know, on the one hand, there was my, he used the phrase, glib and shallow rationalism. You only believe what you can prove. And he just said, look, this was grim, it was grey, it was dismal. You know, it was a very, very small and uninviting world. And then I had this deep sense that there was something bigger, something better. He talks about a many-islanded sea of poetry and myth. In other words, you know, his reason was saying, what you see is what you get, but something deep inside him says there just has to be more than this. And Lewis began to run with his intuitions. And I'm sure many of you here tonight actually know exactly what he's describing. I want you to imagine you live in a world that you only populate with ideas that can be absolutely proven by science or logic. Sure, there'll be some things in there, like the formula for water is H2O, or you know, the average rainfall in the Highlands is whatever. You know, and that could be quite helpful, especially if you're planning a holiday in Scotland. But you know, let's be honest with you, it's not going to be a world that you can meaningfully inhabit. You need to go beyond. Otherwise, you're going to be trapped in a very glib and shallow rationalism, to use Lewis's phrase, which basically doesn't allow you to believe things like rape is wrong, oppression is wrong. You know, these are very fundamental human values, but they don't come from reason alone. So we do need to think about that. And I'll come back to Lewis presently. I studied science. It was very, very exciting. I still love science, but I moved from a position of saying science proves everything that's worth knowing to a sort of gradual realization that it just wasn't that simple. That actually there were a lot more issues than that which pointed to the need for something bigger. Let me try and describe what I mean. None of your scientists can see if you can, you know, just follow me with on these things. The first point I think that needs to be made is this. I mean, science is great. But science is about the empirical. And very often there are things that lie beyond that realm. For example, questions of meaning, questions of value. And there's a very well-known book by a former Nobel laureate, Peter Medawar, who was a biologist at Oxford. And it's called The Limits of Science. He wrote it right at the end of his life as he was just, you know, trying to go out with a blaze of glory, trying to reflect on the wider importance of science. And he was saying, look, science is absolutely wonderful when it comes to clarifying the mechanisms that underlie the natural world. It does that splendidly. It does it really well. But when it comes to what Karl Popper calls ultimate questions, what's the point of life? Why are we here? What is the good? And actually, science isn't able to answer those questions. Sure, it can inform answers, but it doesn't give answers. And that seems to me to be a really important point to spend some time thinking about. It's not a new point. If you read, for example, José Ortega, a very well-known Spanish philosopher, he takes very much the same view. He says, look, science is splendid. It has these admirable qualities of precision and predictability. And he's absolutely right on that. But he then goes on to say it achieves these admirable qualities by leaving untouched ultimate questions. It kind of floats on a level which he describes as secondary, but it never really is able to engage with those big questions of meaning and value. Science, I think, is very, very good at taking things to bits so we can see how they work. We need that. So that's one thing, to take things to bits so we can see how they work. But can we find a way of putting them back together again so we can see what they mean? And that's really one of the things that drove me to discover Christianity. I think a growing realization that actually my youthful atheism didn't actually explain quite as much as I thought it did, that it lacked a kind of intellectual traction, which I just assumed wasn't really very important, until I realized actually there is this issue about how we make sense of this whole world we live in. How do we make sense of what we observe and what we experience? And again, Lewis, I think, is very, very interesting. Lewis talks about a big picture of faith. And he uses a very nice image in one of his lectures of the 1940s to talk about this. He says, I believe in Christianity as I believe the sun has risen, not just because I see it, but because by it I see everything else. It's a very powerful image. Try and imagine it in your mind's eye, that you're on a hillside, it's dark, the sun's rising. As the sun rises, gradually the shadows begin to retreat, the mist gets burned off, you can see more clearly, you can see further than would otherwise be the case. Again, I believe in Christianity as I believe the sun has risen, not just because I see it, but because by it I see everything else. And that certainly was my own experience, that actually Christianity gave me a way of making sense of things. If you like, it's a lens that brings things into focus. It's a way of looking at things that seem to really make sense. And that, I think, is something that Lewis brings out very, very clearly, partly, of course, because that was his experience of walking into and inhabiting this new world of faith, and discovering the new way of seeing things, the new way of living that it made possible. And Lewis certainly was very, very clear. This was in no way about leaving his mind behind him. It was much more about bringing to fruition some of the deepest thoughts he had. And Lewis is a very good example of someone whose reason is enriched by faith, not negated by it. So there's something very interesting here that I think is worth talking about. I'm going to open up two ideas which I think are really important for us as we think about the meaning of life, or indeed the meaning of the world. And the two words I'm going to use are intelligibility and coherence. I think these are important ideas. I'm just going to talk about each of them for a few moments. Intelligibility is about being able to make sense of things. And very often we find unintelligible things deeply unattractive. We feel there's something about them that just means we can't go there. Very often we hold on to ideas that are actually quite unintelligible because our friends want us to or something like that. But in the end, There's a tension within us because we know that actually that just isn't right. And certainly that was the tension Lewis experienced as he began to realize his atheism, you know, it might make a little bit of sense, but not that much. And it was not imaginatively exciting. It did not help Lewis think through these deep questions of meaning and value in his own life. I want to say to you that Christianity is not about running away from reason. It's not about running away from evidence. Rather, it's saying, look, we have these experiences, we look around the world, we see these things, and like any good scientist, you're going to ask this question: what is the best theory for making sense of these observations? And the word theory comes from the Greek word theoria. It just means a way of looking at things, a way of beholding things. And that seems to me to be a very important point to make. For me, in discovering Christianity, it was all about realizing that this way of looking at things actually fitted things in much better than my atheism. I used to think atheism was just a fact, but religion was a kind of faith. I think now, looking back on it, I can see that actually atheism is its own form of faith. My atheist friends believe there is no God. I believe there is a God. The real issue is which of our faiths is better attuned to what we actually see in the world. So I want to begin to open up this point about science. Science is wonderful. It has its limits. I think that is reasonably clear. It also, precisely because it is science, will change its mind in response to accumulated evidence. And that's an important point. Sometimes when I read Richard Dawkins, I get the impression he's saying, look, science has sorted everything out. It's a body of knowledge. It's fixed. It's sorted out. But I think for me, and I suspect for many of you, science is actually on a journey. Actually, it has not arrived at its destination. It's going to keep thinking. It's going to keep building up evidence. And as it does so, it changes its mind from time to time. We could, for example, imagine that we were having this meeting 100 years ago. And suppose the topic of the lecture had been the origins of the universe. Except nobody had been talking about that 100 years ago because the consensus of the day was that the universe has always been here. It's kind of way always been here. Maybe energy moves around locally, but there is no question the universe is infinite, permanent. It's always been there. This religious language about creation just doesn't make sense. Whereas I think you know, in the 20th century, really beginning in the 1920s, but especially in the period after the Second World War, people began to realize that actually the evidence pointed in a very different direction. That however difficult it may be to take this in, the universe came into being in that cosmic fireball we call the Big Bang, and is now expanding. And so we're left with some very, very difficult questions. For example, if the universe is expanding, what does it expand into? And these are not easy questions to answer. But here's the point I want to make. Science is on a journey. It changes its mind sometimes quite radically. And as you can see, that's a very significant change. There was a very famous debate in England in 1948. It took place on Radio 3, which had a very large audience for this event. In one corner was Bertrand Russell, the well-known atheist philosopher. In the other corner was a Christian philosopher who I think probably isn't that well-known today. But basically, they were talking about the question of God. And on the question, for example, of whether you need God to be moral, the Christian won reasonably easily. But Russell won definitively the argument about whether you need God to explain the universe. The universe has always been there. No explanation is necessary. Some of you may know that 50 years later, they replayed this debate. William Lane Craig, who came to speak at his church recently, and the man who then was an atheist, began to debate this same question. And Anthony Flew, who we're talking about, found himself in intense difficulty in talking about this question of whether you can make any sense at all of the Big Bang Either it happened by processes we don't understand, or it made happen by something. And in the end, he moved away from his atheism, not to Christianity, but to a sort of rather vague belief in God, precisely because he felt his atheism had difficulty in coping with this. So you see, there are interesting questions here caused by scientific progress. And Lewis hints at that in some of his writings. Lewis, again, does believe that science is very, very good within its limits. But to go back to that image that I used a few moments ago, if we say, look, we need a big picture of life, and those who are psychologists will know, there's a very large research literature that says this is really what people need to achieve stability and well-being, then how much of that big picture does science fill in? And I can suggest to you it fills in part of that picture. It's very good at telling you how you came to be here. Not quite so good at saying why you're here. Those are very different questions. And I think there are many issues we could look at here, but one of them clearly is, if science is part of the picture, what else is there? And I want to suggest to you that faith, religious faith, actually might well help you fill in part of the rest of that picture. I think that's a point I'm going to be explaining in more detail, but certainly it's something that Lewis himself talks about quite a lot. Lewis is very, very worried about what he calls reductionism, the idea that we simply end up reducing life, reducing ourselves as human beings to very simplistic statements like we're all nothing but atoms and molecules. Well, you know, we are atoms and molecules. So is this pillar. So is this very interesting piece of paper. But I want to suggest to you there is something different between you, this pillar, and this piece of paper. In other words, yes, it's true that we are atoms and molecules, but there's rather more to it than that. And in many ways, the question all of us have to ask is, how do we begin to achieve this life of meaning and purpose and value, which is so important to us as human beings? I want to suggest to you that filling in this big picture actually is very important as part of that. Do you remember earlier I said that science is very good at taking things to bits so we can see how they work, but we do need more than that. We need a way of putting them back together again. And that brings us to this idea of coherence, which is the second major theme I want to look at. Coherence is about things hanging together. Not things being disconnected, but rather, to use the image of the big picture, you're able to see how things are interconnected. I want you to imagine that you are standing on the top of a mountain. Maybe you're in the Alps and you're looking down and you see villages and woods and streams and all kinds of things. And you take little snapshots of, there's a village, there's a stream, there's a wood, there's some people walking. And someone else who's got a much better camera than you have takes a panoramic shot of the whole thing. And as you look at the panoramic shot, takes in the whole thing, you can see how your little snapshot fits in. Look, there's the wood. That goes there. Oh, there's some people. That goes there. There's a house. That goes there. You know, all your snapshots turn out to be part of a bigger picture. They're positioned. They're connected together by that bigger picture. What I'm saying to you is that one of the things that Christianity does very, very well is to give you this interconnected view of life, this way of looking at things which gives you this big picture, which in effect is like a lens that brings things into focus and lets you see how they hang together. And that, I think, again, is a very important idea. Those of you who are scientists may have read the philosopher Mansi Cartwright, who says, look, there are just little local islands of meaning, which are individual, they're discrete, they're disconnected, and that's just the way things are. But actually, you can read things in a very different way, with no loss of intellectual coherence, that there's a better way of looking at this. And in many ways, that's the kind of thing that Lewis is trying to get across in his works. He does this in a number of ways. I'm going to talk about two ways in which Lewis develops ideas that I think you may find interesting. I'd like to talk more about Lewis, but I have to be very respectful of your time and not trespass on that. One of the things that Lewis says is this. He says, look, Christianity gives you this, he used the word map, actually, which is quite a helpful idea, gives you this map for making sense of experience. And he makes the point, sure, look, if we think of a map, you know, a map is a two-dimensional representation of a three-dimensional reality, but it still helps you make sense of it and understand what's going on. And Lewis says that Christian ideas, Christian doctrines, the creeds are a bit like that. They make sense of experience. Here's one way in which Lewis approaches this question. He makes the point that for many people, they have experiences of real desire for something. There seems to be something they're longing for that nothing that's created or finite is able to satisfy. And those of you who've read literature will know there are lots of examples of this, from Dostoevsky, or you might think, in fact, of Bertrand Russell, who I mentioned earlier, who wrote in a letter of 1917 that within him there was a longing for something that was absolutely unsatisfied. He had no idea what was pointing towards, but it was the thing that drove his whole quest for meaning in life. And his daughter said, you know, he never really found it. But that was the thing that haunted her father's life, the sense that there was something he had not grasped, which, if he had done, would have changed everything. And Lewis picks up on this. Lewis says, in effect, look, supposing you look at that experience through a Christian lens. Lewis argues that, in effect, if Christianity is right in saying, look, we are made to relate to God, and if we don't do that, then there's an absence where there ought to be a presence. That there's something we know ought to be part of our lives, but it's not there. And we feel this deep sense of dissatisfaction because we know that we are unable to fill this gap within us. And you may think of Pascal's idea of an abyss within us, which only God can fulfill. Or you might think of that very famous prayer from Augustine of Hippo, a Christian writer of the 5th century, who said, you have made us for yourself, and our hearts are restless until they find their rest in you. And the point that all these writers, Lewis, Pascal, Augustine, are making is, look, there's something within the human heart which is saying there is more to life than what reason is able to deliver. There's something just beyond reason's reach, but it's not irrational, which in effect we are meant to discover. And Lewis uses a whole host of beautiful images to try and describe this. And of course, it was a very important part of his own life. But his basic point is that Christianity gives you a lens that makes sense of this experience and shows you not simply what it means, but how it can be resolved. So that's a very silly example in some ways, because there's so many other things I could add to it. But the point that Lewis is making is that Christianity has this capacity to make sense of things. Now, sure, it's more than that. It engages your heart, not just your mind. It engages your imagination by opening up new ways of thinking. But at rock bottom, it's a way of making sense of things which actually works very well. The second point that Lewis brings out very clearly is the importance of stories in shaping human meaning and identity. And those who are here tonight who are cultural anthropologists will probably have read hundreds of articles about this, because it's a very, very well-established phenomenon, actually, both as individuals and as groups of people. We very often use stories as a way of making sense of things. And that, I think, is something that is well worth exploring further. Why do we do this? But there seems to be something about us that makes us want to use stories in this way. And for Lewis, this is very important. One of the things that brought Lewis not so much to faith in God, but to faith in Christianity, was a long conversation in 1931 with his close friend J.R.R. Tolkien. And we have a long letter from Lewis describing that conversation. One of the reasons why it's so interesting to read that letter is that back in 1931, no one had heard of C.S. Lewis. No one had heard of J.R.R. Tolkien. But this conversation was all about the place of stories that capture the imagination and convey meaning. And for Lewis, Tolkien helped them to realize that Christianity fundamentally told a story that captures the imagination, and as you think about this story, it begins to make rational sense as well. For Lewis, the story comes first, the doctrines come second, but it's all there as part of the same big picture. And for Lewis, Christianity appeals to the imagination, not just the reason. And again, we're coming towards Christmas when we'll retell the Christmas story, and actually it very often resonates with some deep intuitions within our hearts. But of course, the classic example of Lewis using stories to make sense of things are the Chronicles of Narnia. And many of you will have read those, or at least you'll have read The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. And for those of you who are able to do this, I want you to imagine that you're with the children as they enter Narnia for the first time. And it's a very strange place, and they're puzzled by it. But as they explore it, they hear stories being told about it. And as they hear these stories, they realize that they can't all be right. You know, is Narnia really the realm of this white witch? Or is it something to do with this noble lion called Aslan? He's not there at the moment, but one day he's going to come back and everything will change. And they try to figure out which of the stories is the one they should trust. And I've used that word trust very deliberately. Not just saying this is right, but actually we can hang on to this. It helps to make sense. It's something that can be built upon. It's something that gives a foundation for your lives. And Lewis is making a very important point, that Christianity tells a story which, in his view, can be trusted. And he takes us a stage further, which I think is very, very interesting. He looks at each of the individual children, both in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and, of course, in the subsequent Chronicles of Narnia series. And one of the things you see emerging is this, that each of the children, each of the leading characters of these novels has their own personal story. And they're wondering how to make sense of that and how to bring that story to fulfillment. And Lewis's argument is that our own personal stories are brought to fulfillment when we actually become part of a bigger story, which gives us meaning and dignity. And the point that Lewis, I think, is trying to bring out, that faith in one sense is about allowing our own personal story to become part of something bigger, so that what we do is not just affecting us, but actually moves this bigger story on. Now, when you read the Chronicles of Narnia, you can see how Lewis does that. But what I want to say to you is that in terms of the Christian faith, there's a very fundamental insight which Lewis is articulating so well. And that is that each of us matters profoundly to God, that each of us has something special that maybe we can do and nobody else. And that's something that helps move this bigger story of life, of faith, onwards. So Lewis is really helping us to realize that one of the things we have to think about is how we make sense of our own individual narratives, how we actually move those on, how we achieve what we are meant to achieve and become what we're meant to be. And that's a line of his thought which I think really is very interesting and worth looking at in much more detail. But I haven't really time to do that because I want to step back a little bit and just think about this. I'm going to go back and talk a little bit about the relationship between faith and science simply because it opens up some very good questions, which those of you who aren't scientists can easily transpose into your own disciplines. I'm going to look at an example from physics. And what I want you to do is just bear in mind this image I gave you, which is a bit derivative, it comes from Lewis, of a big picture where science fills in part of the picture, but you're aware that there is more that needs to be said. Let's look at a letter Albert Einstein wrote on hearing of the death of his friend Michel Besser, who was a very well-known Zurich physicist who'd helped Einstein in his early career. And he wrote to the family, Einstein wrote to the family just saying how sad this all was. And he said, look, you know, those of us who are physicists know that death isn't really all that important, that this sense of meaning is purely illusory, that this whole distinction between past, present, and future is simply an unimportant illusion. Now, I often wonder how Besso's family reacted when they read those words, because I think they might have expected a bit more than that. But those of you who are physicists will know that actually Einstein is right at the level of physics. You know, you can draw a timeline. There's position 1, x1, z, y1, z1, t1. There's another place. There's x2, yz, 2, t2. And, you know, at some point along that line, we're alive. At some point, we're dead. At another point, you haven't come to being yet. But in a very famous conversation with the philosopher Rudolf Carnap, you know, Einstein just said, actually, I'm aware that this isn't enough, that human beings need more if they are going to be human beings. Actually, this whole issue of meaning is really important, and it lies just on the far side of physics. And the point that Rudolf Carnap made was just, look, Einstein realized that while science has some very good things to say, it wasn't enough to give us that existential traction which you and I need as human beings. So again, science fills in part of the picture, but as you can see, there's a great big gap there. And that's something I think that's very important. How do we see the full picture? How do we hold together fact and meaning, the two major themes in our cultural conversations at the moment? It's hard, but I want to say to you, it comes absolutely naturally when you bring together faith and science in this way. So let me then begin to wrap things up. What I want to do is to suggest to you that, following C.S. Lewis, Christianity gives us a new way of seeing things. It's not random, it's not arbitrary, it's not irrational. It's different. It's the Christian way of looking at things. And at times it resonates quite strongly with ideas in our culture. At times it takes us in a very different direction. At times, it in effect says to us, look, things that maybe we think are very important, like status, power, and so on, actually aren't quite as important as our culture says. And so it's about raising questions, but above all, it's about trying to say to all of us, we need to find a big picture that makes sense of our lives. One of the big questions we ask is, do we really matter? And that, I think, is a very important question to ask. Because very often, many of us feel we're overwhelmed. We are lost in the midst of a vast universe. And certainly, when I was younger myself, I was an atheist. I used to sometimes lie awake at night and look at the night sky. And I knew just about enough about astronomy to know that the light leaving from those stars there left about 100 years ago. And by the time it got to Earth, well, I'd be dead, you know, it's 100 years. And so for me, the night sky was a very melancholy symbol of human transience and insignificance. Then I discovered this Christian way of thinking. And actually, it does mean you see things in a completely different way. For me now, the night sky certainly speaks again of my smallness, but it speaks to me of a God who cares for me. A God who is always there as I journey through life, not as a distant observer, but rather as someone who walks with me, even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death. And that's, to me, a very important theme, that it's not just about understanding things more. It's about being able to cope with things. And those are very important distinctions. It's really about head and heart, but they are brought together in a very significant way. So I was talking a bit about Lewis, and I'm going to end this lecture now by just bringing together some themes that Lewis himself expressed in some of his writings that I think are very important to us tonight. The first point that Lewis makes is that we just need to realize that reason does have its limits. And when we trust reason, very often it doesn't deliver what we're looking for. And so mistakenly we very often say, therefore, because reason can't answer these questions, there are no reliable answers to be had. And Lewis would say that that is, in effect, a recognition of the limits of reason, but not, in effect, an invalidation of the questions. You may know that very famous quote from Pascal, you know, the supreme achievement of reason is to be able to demonstrate its limits. And that is a very important topic for us tonight. I've talked about faith making sense. I've made it absolutely clear this is not about kind of way leaving reason behind. Rather, it's about realizing reason's limits, but respecting it as far as it goes. To have faith is not about, if I can put it like this, rejecting reason. Rather, it's about transcending reason's limits. You know, and the point that Lewis makes throughout many of his writings, it's even there in the Chronicles of Narnia, is that we're aware of something that seems to beckon us from beyond the limits of reason. It's almost as if the scent of a flower is wafting into our lives. There's something that says to us, there must be more than this, and invites us to discover it. And that's what Lewis did. And I think it's very important just to realize that in embracing this new vision of reality, Lewis was not becoming irrational, but rather expanding his vision of what reason was able to do. But I think the final point that I'd want to make from Lewis is this. Lewis is very, very clear that as human beings, we need more than just reasons to keep us going. That really we want something that engages the mind, certainly, but also engages our hearts. That's about love. And also our imaginations, by in effect exciting us and making us realize that there's a bigger vision of reality there than what we've actually grasped. And so in one sense tonight, this lecture has really been an invitation to read C.S. Lewis. I mean, his Mere Christianity is always worth reading. But more fundamentally, it's about appreciating the importance of something that Lewis tries to bring out so clearly. And that is that Christianity is able to engage the imagination, the reason, the heart. It gives us this big picture, which helps to make sense of things, but also reassures us that we really matter. My final point. You may know that very famous story about the Voyager space probe on its way to the outer realms of the solar system. And Carl Sagan persuaded NASA, once it got way, way from Earth, to turn the camera backward and photograph where it came from. And if you look at the picture, there's one single pale blue pixel in the midst of a sort of ocean of blackness. And Sagan just says, look, that tiny little dot is, it's us, that's where we live. It really matters to us, but it's so insignificant compared with the vastness of space. That's right, but it's only part of the picture. We may be small, but from a Christian perspective, each of us really matters. Psalm 8 reminds us that when we look at the heavens and just think how wonderful they are, it brings home to us how small we are, but also reminds us that we matter to God. That mattered to Lewis profoundly. And so in this talk tonight, I've tried to bring out mainly the fact that Lewis said Christianity makes rational sense, which it does. But he's also trying to bring out the fact it appeals to the heart as well. It's all about finding the heart's desire and beginning a journey of discovery as you inhabit and explore this wonderful new world that faith makes possible. Now, there's much more I need to say, but I think it would be much more useful if we allowed you to direct the conversation for the next 40 minutes or so. And I'm very happy now just to take questions from anyone. I'm going to invite Keith just to explain the practicalities of this, but we'll just see how many questions we can get through. Thank you very much indeed for listening.